So firstly, thank you very much to the Sandlers for sponsoring. It's my pleasure to be here as always. And the learning should be Lilui Nishmat Mordechai Leib Ben Aaron. I wanted to talk a little bit about Purim. We're heading towards Purim. And the title is a primer on religious intoxication, which is a little bit of baiting, because I'm not only going to talk about drinking on Purim. That's not really the main goal. But what I want to talk about is Purim as a lived experience. Generally speaking, just by way of introduction, in terms of holidays in Judaism, I think it's useful to make a distinction between things which commemorate, which are commemorative, and things which we do where we try and relive experiences from the past. And that happens a lot also. So for example, Hanukkah is mostly commemorative. You light the candles, we remember what happened, that's nice. On the other hand, say something like Pesach, where we say that a person has to see themselves as though they came out of Egypt, as though they came out of Mitzrayim, so that is an attempt to relive an experience. Tisha B'Av is another good example. We do all of the acts of mourning. It's not just a commemoration. We're trying to relive some kind of experience. We spend a long time, 3 weeks, 9 days, sort of ramping up and getting ready, and that's an attempt to relive an experience. So what I want to argue today is that Purim has commemorative components, but it also jumps over into the world of lived experience, of trying to relive an experience that the Jews had in the time of the Purim story. And I want to look at a few examples, and by way of the examples, try and get an idea of what exactly is the experience, what is the religious message that we're trying to gain out of Purim. So the first example is Ta'anit Esther. We have the fast of Esther. And if I would ask you, you know, what is the fast of Esther about? What is it based on? Why do we do the fast of Esther? Any thoughts? It says in the Megillah you have to fast, okay. But which fast? What fast is it about? Esther's fast. Oh, and it's called Ta'anit Esther, so that's a dead give. Well, you know, that may be circular. But whatever. But that's what, you know, you would imagine. The Ta'anit Esther means we're commemorating the fast that Esther did, right? The fast that she commanded all the Jews to do. Fast for 3 days, then I'm going to go to Achashverosh. And in fact, we find that that's for sure the position of the Rambam. And we'll see in a moment. So in source number one, we have the story at the end of the Megillah, which discusses all of the rules, all of the commemorations, all of the different things that the Jews set up to do, accepted upon themselves to do in the wake of the story of the Megillah. And you have Yishlach Sfarim El Kol Yehudim, Mordechai and Esther sent out books, El Sheva Ve'esrim Meima Medina, Malchut Achashverosh, Divrei Shalom Ve'emet. Fine, they sent out these books. What does it say in the books? L'chayem et Yimei HaPurim, to keep these days of Purim Ha'ela B'zmanehem, Kasher Kiyam Aleha Mordechai Yehudi Ve'Esther HaMalka, as Mordechai and the Jew and Queen Esther had commanded, V'Kasher Kaimu Al Nafsham Val Zaram Divrei Tzomot V'Zah. And just like they've accepted upon themselves and on their descendants, the obligation or the words of the fasts and their lamentations or their outcries, some kind of fasting is involved. It was accepted as part of the Purim story. So the Rambam says this is referring to the fast that they did in the course of the story that Esther did. That's in source 2. Nagu kol Yisrael bizmanehem elu lihitanot b'shlosha asar be'adar. The practice of all of the Jews in this time is to fast on the 13th day of Adar. Zecher letani chitanu b'imei Haman. In memory of the fast that they fasted in the days of Haman, sheneamar divrei etzomot v'zakatam. They accepted the fasts and the outcries. So according to the Rambam, it's exactly what we would have expected, and that's what I would have thought also, is that the Megillah includes a story of a fast, and we're commemorating that fast. It actually happened probably around Pesach time, so really, the 13th day of Adar has nothing to do with that fast, it's just a commemoration. Good, we should commemorate. Fine. There is an alternative view. The alternative view is based in source number 3, which is part of the description of the war that the Jews fought against their enemies, right? They were given license to go and fight against their enemies. And the 13th day was a day when all of the Jews were fighting. The Jews in Shushan continued on to the 14th day, and that's what we have described here. Bayom Shlosha Asar Lechodesh Adar, Venoach, they fought on the 13th day, Venoach Barbasar Bo, and then they rested, the Jews outside of Shushan, on the 14th day, Vasoto Yom Mishtevi Simcha, they made the 14th day into a happy day. Vayehudim asher b'Shushan nikhalu b'shlosha sarbo. The Jews in Shushan, they we're gonna have to translate that, but they got together, they mustered courage, they gathered together on the 13th day and on the 14th day, and then rested on the 15th day and made that into a happy day. Okay, so we know for sure all of the Jews definitely fought in wars. It's called Yemei Kehilah, days of community, on the 13th day of Adar. And the She'iltot of Rav Chai Gaon claims that not only were they fighting wars, they were also fasting on that day when they were fighting, which again, you can ask your military religious experts whether it's a good idea to fast when you're fighting a war or not, but that's what he assumes that they were doing. And when we fast on the 13th day of Adar, it's not to commemorate some other day where Esther and the Jews fasted for 3 days at some other random point in the year. We're actually redoing the fast that the Jews did as part of the Purim story. We're reliving their experience. That's the idea. And this is what Rav Chai Gaon says. Valtanit bein hakrachim, bein kfarim, bein ayirot, kulan mitanin b'shlosha asar ba'adar. There are different rules about reading the Megillah, and the Gemara talks about at different places, read it on different days depending on the circumstances, but everybody fasts on the 13th day of Adar. Why? Because this was the Zman Kehilah Lakol. This was the time of gathering my Kehilah Yom Ta'anit. What is gathering together? A day of fasting. So according to Rav Chai Gaon, the fast of Esther is not just a commemoration. It's an attempt to relive the experience of the Jews in the time of the Megillah. And it seems to be that there's something to be said for having the experience of taking a day of fasting and then moving into a day of celebration. Just like they had the war, it was a little bit tense, everybody's fighting, we don't know exactly how it's going to work out, and everything did work out, and they moved into a day of celebration the next day. We're supposed to be reliving that experience to a certain extent. That's element number one in terms of experience. Element number two, which we can suggest, is the reading of the Megillah itself. And there's a curious sort of statement which we have to deal with. And the question that arises on Purim is why we don't say Hallel. It's a big salvation for the Jews. It's a Yeshua. We should be saying Hallel. We say it on Hanukkah. Full Hallel all day. Why don't we say Hallel on Purim? So there's a number of answers which are suggested in the Gemara. The last one is what I want to deal with here. We have it in source number 5. The Gemara asks, we should say Hallel. Why don't we say Hallel on Purim? So one possibility is because we don't say a Hallel on a miracle that occurred outside of Israel, and that raises all kinds of technical issues because they did say Hallel. What about when we came out of Egypt? Whatever, fine. The second answer, which I want to deal with, is Rav Nachman Amar, Kriyata Zu Halila. Reading the Megillah is an accomplishment of Hallel. Which is very strange, because Hallel, you know, you can debate exactly what it's about, but at least part of it is about thanking God for stuff that God did for us. But what's the big problem with the Megillah? There's no mention of God. God doesn't come up. Exactly. God's not in the Megillah. There's no mention of God in the Megillah. So we have a problem. How can you say that reading the Megillah counts as Hallel when at the same time there's no mention of God in the Megillah? So what's the answer? Any thoughts? Yeah, God caused the events of the Megillah, but what I'm getting at here is, it means, yeah. Right, everything's right, okay, yep.
When Hamelech has mentioned that,
it could be that it does, right. But what I'm getting at is, you already have to go and do a little bit, you have to read or be a little bit more active of a reader to get to the conclusion that God is the one that was doing everything in the Megillah. You can't just read the Megillah and say, oh, now we've accomplished Hallel. In order to have an experience, in order to say Hallel, in order for the Megillah to count in some way as Hallel, you have to read it and move one step beyond the text of the Megillah to say, oh, it must be God who's really involved in doing all of this. And that's exactly what the Vilna Gaon says in source number 6. We'll just read it in the English. He suggests that this is the idea. This is part of what we're supposed to get out of the Megillah. In the Megillah, the Megillah wrote this. He's discussing the fact that there's all kinds of background story in the Megillah which doesn't seem relevant to the actual plot. Why do we have to know about who Mordechai was and where he came from and the fact that Esther was installed as the queen and the whole background story? What do we need that for? It's to show the greatness of God who set the chains of events into motion to cause a miracle for Israel. Because Mordechai was already in Shushan, as it states, a man of Yehuda, or maybe it should be Jew, I will admit to that. That is, he was already there. That is to say, he was already there and God caused and led Ahasuerus to settle there. Therefore, the sages said we must read all of it, because presumably one may ask, why do we need to know about the might of Ahasuerus? But the answer is that in each and every pasuk, the Megillah relates the greatness of the miracle. But the miracle occurred with a hidden face. That is to say, he caused it to occur through nature, not like the miracle of Egypt, which occurred with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. So the idea inside of the Megillah is, as we noted, you're supposed to read the Megillah, and as you read the Megillah, to come to recognition, oh, it wasn't just random. God caused all of these things to happen. And that already moves you from a place of just reading passively and commemorating something to an actual experience. We'll discuss this a little bit. If anyone was there when we did the Tanakh, yes.
Why do you need to read on other occasions when it's even explicit that it was God?
So on other occasions, we don't have a text like this, right? We're commemorating some event. You're happy. Yeah, you say Hallel. In this case, the way that Chazal set it up was that you read the Megillah, and through reading the Megillah, you come to a recognition that God was the one that did all of these things. And as you come to that recognition, that in itself accomplishes Hallel, because you feel a sense of gratitude for what God did. As I mentioned it a little bit, if anyone was there when we did our Tanakh in a Day program, but the Megillah is actually set up in this way to try and make an argument to show you that the entire thing was designed, was God's plan. It's set up in a giant structure of parallels, a chiastic structure where the first point parallels the last point, then the second point parallels the second last point, and it's sort of like this pyramid which is pointing to the fact that, you know, it happened to be at a certain night, at a certain time, Ahasuerus couldn't sleep, and that, you know, the entire events of the Megillah sort of unwound. Haman had this whole plan. He tried to set up the Jews. He tried to get rid of them, and God created this whole set of circumstances which seemed all too coincidental and led to Haman's downfall. So that is the idea in terms of reading the Megillah. And this is what Rav David Cohen says in source number 7. This is exactly why it counts as an example, or counts as saying Hallel. The entire process of enunciating Hallel on Purim occurs through reading the Megillah and not through the recital of Hallel. The basis for this, we have explained that it is not appropriate to say Hallel on actions of God which are concealed within natural law. Therefore, the only reason for reciting Hallel over the redemption of Purim is that through connecting all of the events of the story together, it becomes clear and revealed that this redemption was impossible except through the strength of His great name, which is the guiding force that is beyond the forces of nature. We find, therefore, that there is no basis for reciting Hallel except by way of reading the Megillah. So he pegs it a little bit on a technicality, but I think the point is the same. You read the Megillah. The Megillah is supposed to be more than just the recitation of a text, more than just something interesting. It's supposed to generate a certain kind of experience, a certain kind of recognition that just like God was behind all of these events, there's a broader perspective to be gained there that God is behind events on a regular basis, regular things that happen. Yeah.
He said we don't have a Megillah, but we have a Haggadah.
Yeah. I mean, there is a Hallel incorporated into the Haggadah, so that is true. Right, okay, so this is a unique sort of, it could be it's combined with some of the other technical reasons, but it's clear if this is going to count as a reading of Hallel at all, the recognition of God acting in these events has to come through, and that's part of what the Megillah is about. So that's point two. Yeah. That's true. Yeah, Megillah is sort of like a unique. The Megillah is sort of like a unique thing. In that sense. Okay, so we have this idea of the fast. The fast is clearly meant to be an experience, at least according to some opinions. The reading of the Megillah also is supposed to generate, it's supposed to be move beyond just reading something, but to generate a certain kind of experience. And that brings us to finally to the question of drinking on Purim. And this is a full disclaimer here. This is not a halachic discussion. And in terms of the practical application of these rules, I'm fully aware that there's a broad range of opinions which range from drinking lots of things to drinking nothing, and everyone should consult a competent authority. But I want to show how the conceptually what we've been talking about fits in at least with some of the discussion about drinking as well. So in source number 8, you have the basis, the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch describes drinking on Purim. Chayev inish levesume bepuria ad delo yada bein Aru Haman lebaruch Mordechai. So a person is required to become intoxicated on Purim to the point where he does not know the difference between Arur Haman and Baruch Mordechai. Cursed is Haman, blessed is Mordechai. We'll have to discuss exactly what that means. I think that phrase has been interpreted more ways than almost anything in the Torah. Yesh omrim, de'ein tzarech lehishtacher kol kach, you don't have to, and so the Ramah, that's the view of the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says very plainly, simply have to drink until you don't know the difference between these two things. What exactly that means we'll come back to. The Ramah, for his part, adds, and some people say, you don't need to do this. Ein tzarech lehishtacher kol kach, you shouldn't get so drunk, ela yishtei yoter milimudo, you should drink a little bit more than you're used to, a little bit more than you normally do, and you should go to sleep, and when you go to sleep, you don't know anything. You don't know Haman, you don't know Mordechai, you don't know what day it is. You're asleep, so it's fine. Mitoch sheyishan, eino yodei bein Ar Haman lebaruch Mordechai. Fine, so that's okay. That all makes sense. These are two classic views. One view says drink a lot. One view says drink basically nothing. Fine. Then the Ramah adds a point here which is interesting. Ve'echad hamarbe, ve'echad hamamit, ubilvad sheyichavein libo l'shamayim. It's okay to do it this way, it's okay to do it that way, it's okay to drink a lot, it's okay to drink a little bit, as long as your heart is inclined towards heaven, you're doing it for proper religious purposes. It's very interesting, because we say this in some places. You know, some people say it about learning Torah. The Gemara says this phrase about learning Torah. If you didn't manage to learn so much Torah, it's okay, you know, echad hamamit, echad hamarba, as long as you had the proper intentions. But usually you don't say this in halacha, like, either it's this or it's that. You shouldn't, you know, why do you get an option of what, how exactly you want to do this? So what I think actually is the case is that the Ramah is basing himself on a view, which he doesn't spell out clearly, that holds that drinking on Purim is an option. You could, you know, do a little bit of, you could have a glass of wine, and that would be fine. And if you want to, you can drink a lot, but it's lemitzvah lo leikuva. It's an option. You can do it if you want to, but you don't need to. And the question is, yeah.
What's the purpose of not knowing the distinction between Mordechai and Haman? The whole idea is to know the difference between Mordechai and Haman.
Okay, so we're going to come back. That we're going to get to that right now. So the question is, this is the technical structure here. That the Ramah is basing himself on this view that you could do this if you want to. You could drink a lot and that would be okay. Alternatively, you can just have a little bit and that will be fine and that's perfectly okay. How do you explain this distinction philosophically? What is it based on? What's the idea? What's the reasoning? So I thought that it was very instructive to look at the source number 9. This is the perspective of the Taz. But we can just read it in English. This is his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. And he explains, yet another explanation, what does it mean that you don't know the distinction between Haman and Mordechai? He says, many have wanted to respond and explain the intention in this and hasn't been settled. In my humble opinion, it is explained as follows. A person must give praise to God on the double goodness which he did for us. There's two good things that happened on Purim. First is the punishment which he brought to Haman. right? Haman planned to kill the Jews, and God got rid of that problem. We ended up safe. That was good. That was already good. And even if Mordechai had not been blessed, but was just saved with all of Israel, it would have been enough for us. Dayenu. He says Dayenu. But he even blessed Mordechai with greatness and exceeding goodness. It wasn't just that the Jews were safe. They ended up in a much stronger political situation. They were in power. They had ability to do things. Mordechai, who was the big tzaddik, was shown to be a great person. So that's a double goodness. Therefore, it says that we must become intoxicated until we can't distinguish between our uplifting through the curse of Haman, that is to say, his downfall, and the blessing of Mordechai, which is our second uplifting. And the intention in their saying, until he does not know, is before his intoxication he knew and gave praise about these things. Their intention was that we should not stop giving praise for these with joy until he reaches the point where he cannot discern between them, and then he is relieved of his duty. The Taz says that and it's a little bit strange, right? We have to understand exactly what this means. The Taz says the goal here is to praise God over the things that he did, which, you know, essentially speaking, is a commemoration, right? In the terms that we've been using until now, God did something good in the past. Let's commemorate it. This is what the good thing was that happened. Great. We're happy about it. That's wonderful. And the Taz says, but the ultimate goal here, the ad lo yada, is to reach some sort of phase where I can't tell the difference between this good thing God did and that good thing God did. Is this better? Is that better? What's the point there? Why would we want to do that? Why do I want to blur the lines between all the different things that God did? And I think perhaps it fits in with the rest of the points that we've been developing here. That this is part of the moving from a commemoration of what happened in the past into a sort of lived experience in the moment, to gain an experience and a perspective on the world that God just wasn't just involved at that time and he does this good thing and that good thing, but that ultimately everything that's happening in the world, you know, the entire reality that we live in is filled with the presence of God. God's acting, he's helping, he's saving. It's a constant reality. That's not a way that we normally live. You normally live, you know, have to be a little bit careful. You can't live in the world with the assumption that God is constantly involved saving me at every moment. But it is a level of consciousness which is perhaps being suggested here for us to access on Purim, perhaps. And this could explain, maybe, this distinction that we have found in the Ramah. The Ramah says, look, you want to treat this as a commemoration? That's great. The whole thing happened with wine, and we're really happy, so you have a meal, just like we have any other meal, where you have wine, and that's a festive meal, and you commemorate what happened, and that's great. If you want to, if you feel that you can, under special circumstances, then you can try and reach this higher level, where you move past the commemoration, and move towards some kind of experience, an experience of God in your life, an experience in where you can look around at the world, or look at your own life, or look at the reality around us, and see the presence of God involved in it. Just like when you read the Megillah, and the goal is to see God acting, you know, behind the scenes. That sort of experience is supposed to be transferred into our own life. That might be the goal here. So again, this is not for every time and every place, and I'm not suggesting this necessarily practically, but this might be the meaning here. The meaning might be to move from a commemoration to an experience. So just to recap, what we've said is that there's a distinction in terms of religious holidays, in terms of Jewish holidays, between things which commemorate and things which are more of a lived experience. And I wanted to present three indications that Purim sort of moves into the world of experience. One is the fast, at least according to the She'iltot, according to one view, is really an attempt to redo, to relive the original experience of the fast of the Jews in the story of the Megillah. The reading of the Megillah itself is this attempt. You can't read it straight. You have to read it in an involved way, in a way that causes you to see God acting behind the scenes. It becomes more of an experience than it does simply a recitation of something, and that's why it counts as a recitation of the Hallel. And finally, the idea of drinking on Purim, which may be limited to a very basic thing, similar to what we have in the rest of the holidays, as much more of a commemorative act, and potentially maybe something which is catapulted beyond this into an area or into a level of consciousness where you have a sense of God being imminent and present in our lives constantly. So this sort of experience requires a bit of preparation, and that's why it's good that we're getting on this early. It's just the beginning of Adar, and perhaps this is part of the idea, you know, that we talk about. Mishenichnas Adar marbin besimcha. When Adar starts, you're supposed to increase your level of joy. That all might be part of this notion of getting ready for Purim. You can't just jump into something. It's easy to jump into something if you're commemorating it. It's much harder to jump into something if you're attempting to relive it or experience it. Okay, thank you very much.